So today we have a conversation with Annie Haslam, who I first heard when she recorded with Renaissance, the album Sherazade, which the song was absolutely riveting, brilliant. She has a voice that covers a 5-octave spectrum. I don't even know what that means, except it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary.
Extraordinary enough that it's the second entry on her Wikipedia page.
Yes, yes. But she does have a beautiful soprano voice. And I first came across her in person when she recorded with Steve Howe. And I thought then, gosh, that voice would do wonders for Yes. Too political to go into that. And then you and I both met her at Nearfest. And that was wonderful too. She had a stand opposite us with all her paintings. Can you remember that?
Yes, very clearly. And one of the things I remember as well was I didn't just think they were beautiful. They were very nostalgic for me because they reminded me quite a lot of Rudolf Steiner sort of paintings. Those sort of light feeling, emanating shapes. And
yes,
we're going to put some images in the show notes, I think. But yeah, beautiful. Remember.
I love them. And I did think I mentioned in the talk that I had my eye on one called Blithe Spirit, but I was just too slow. It got sold before I plucked up the nerve to wander over and ask after it.
That's what commissions are for.
Well, I do now have a few of her paintings, and hopefully we'll have them up on the screen with the talk. Anyway, the talk was amazing because I knew she was amazing singer, amazing musician, an amazing artist, but she is such a wonderful, warm, and very funny person, isn't she?
Yeah, I was saying in the first recording of when we tried to do this intro, one of the things that I find amazing about her to listen to is she has all of these stories, and you just sort of start thinking, they can't have all happened to one person. And it's the same with Rick when he talks. You just sort of think, why do these things keep happening to you? And it sort of makes you just sort of feel like the universe keeps giving these people these experiences because there's no one who could put them into words better. And even in this conversation, she actually has a talk about Rick and a story involving the two of them, which is fantastic as well.
Yes, she's brilliant. She's really brilliant. Yeah, it was brilliant fun. We must do that again. I hope she will agree to do it again.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and this was one of my favorite episodes. It's just really so uplifting and hilarious. And I love as well how she sort of pre-apologizes for her stories, but then plows straight in. I think it's 5 minutes in that we hear some story about her getting some ceramic from a toilet stuck in her bum. There's something for everyone in this episode. Art, music, the supernatural, lots of toilet stories. Not from Dad, but
well, yes, there was lots of, it was, yes, it was fantastic. So
a lot of nodding along from Dad, not able to contribute.
Well,
but I really hope we get Annie again. I could listen to her for hours.
Yes, me too. Me too. So Annie Haslam, astonishingly amazing singer with an angel's voice, brilliant artist, and fabulous raconteur. Brilliant. A brilliant, beautiful, funny, brave lady. Annie Haslam.
And you stop there, Dad.
Okay. We are recording.
Well, hello, Roger.
Hello, Annie. I was thinking, I can't work out the dates, but when we were in Nearfest.
Yes.
Were you living where you are now when you're at Nearfest?
Yeah. And I think that was around 2006, 2008, something like that. It was.
Yeah, you've been there 10 years now.
Yeah, we hadn't got the band back together at that point, and I got there. Let's see, I saw you twice there, didn't I? The first time I was upstairs. That's right. That's the first time I met you, because I met Freya at the same time. Right. Now, how old was Freya then?
Well, that would have been 20 years ago, nearly. Yeah,
because
she was 12.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, so, 12 or 13, I forget, but in there.
Yeah, I was 12 once when I lived in Bolton, not Lumb.
How did you manage that? I don't think I was.
How did I manage being 12?
I explained to Freya once that blokes freeze at 12. Whatever they're doing at 12, that's what they do forever.
Well, you know what? My mum and dad, we lived in Bolton, two down outside toilet. I sat on, we had a potty, you know, Jerry we called it in those days. And under my mum and dad's bed, because we had an outside toilet. So if I wanted to go to the toilet in the night, I'd have to creep into their bedroom and pull the Jerry out and take... Should I be telling you? Well, yeah, because it's important, because it left a scar, the actual scar. What happened was I took it out onto the landing, sat on it, and a piece of the porcelain went straight, just missed my spine, just missed the base of my spine.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, it was very painful. My dad, I remember... did we get an ambulance or did we walk? I don't know. You know, it's so different back then. But we didn't have a telephone.
No,
so
we
might have gone up, we might have got on the bus. Oh, my God. And I remember, you know, being in the theatre and my father banging on the door, let me in, because they gave me a local anaesthetic. Well, local, you know, because they had to go in deep, really didn't do very much. So I was in agony, you know. But anyway, my mum and dad, yeah, were talking about that age. I guess it was around that age, 11 or 12, my mum and dad sent me to elocution lessons. And I thought, why are they doing this to me, you know? I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was 11. But they must have known something was going to happen for me. I think that's why they were wonderful parents, you know. They encouraged my brother Michael, who ended up singing and being managed by Brian Epstein. You know, they bought him a guitar. They bought him a banjo first and a guitar, and then, you know, just, and they really couldn't afford it. Sent me to elocution lessons because I talk like this. Yeah, yeah, right. Come on, man, let's have you. That's how I used to speak, you know. Can I have a piece of cake?
That's brilliant.
Cake. But and they must have known, really, I'm thinking, that they encouraged me. They let me go to a secondary art school in Bolton. Because I guess they knew that they must have seen me drawing or something.
Right.
And so they knew that that was a part of it. Did you ever get anything like that with you? How did you start? Did you start when you were really young? Were you encouraged? Was it just, or was your parents, did they write or did they paint as well?
Weirdly, my mum did. She went to the same art school as me. She did.
Really?
Yeah, she did fashion, or fashion drawing anyway.
Right.
And I was just getting a whole bunch of her drawings scanned this last couple of weeks. And my dad did watercolors, but he was an engineer in the army. So I was, when I was 12, I was in at St. George's School in Hong Kong, which was brilliant. I mean, it was such a fantastic place to be, age 12. And yeah. Hong Kong was great for music because American Forces Radio had rock and roll nonstop. And that would have been 1956, seven, or 1958. So it was, I loved it there. And I loved that I traveled with my parents all the time in the army. The schooling was rubbish.
Well, I can see that.
Yeah, well, it was.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean that.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, I've never been to Hong Kong, been to Japan and that, but so tell me when you started painting then. I mean, naturally doing paintings, do you know what I mean? Rather than the drawings and doodles and things like that, which is how I started, I think.
Well, when I went to art school, I had two ambitions, really. One to design the future and one to draw natural history, animals, insects, lizards, that kind of stuff. So being in Hong Kong was terrific for that. But when I went to art school, it was mostly industrial design. I had no inkling that I would end up painting. I designed this upstairs seating for Ronnie Scott's jazz club. Had you ever played there?
No, I think I went there once in the 60s, I think, but I don't remember who it was I went to see. But no, we never played there, no.
Okay, well, I did the seating upstairs in 1968, so it was back then. And they were quite enthusiastic about what I designed, but I showed them my sketchbook to show them what I wanted to do if we had more than 2 weeks, because we had 2 weeks to design and build it. And they said, oh, can we use that as an album cover? So that's
that was the beginning.
Yeah.
Wow.
I remember at Nearfest sitting opposite where you had a stand and really, really liking your paintings. And I'd made up my mind I was going to go and buy one. I had my eye on it. And I don't know why I hesitated, because when I went across, how far was it? 10 meters, 20 feet, whatever 15, it was.
15 feet.
Yeah. When I went across to buy it, it had gone. So I bought another one, and I realized I probably bought the one I really should have bought in the first place. Although I was a bit annoyed that I was too slow off the mark.
Yeah, Rob bought it, didn't he? One of the Nearfest promoters.
You're right. Yes, God, yeah.
I could see it right in front of me because it had that thing floating in the sky, didn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was amazing because I had not known what you could do with Golden Open, which is what you were using.
I wasn't using it then. I don't. Was I? Let me think, because it's way back, isn't it? I wasn't using it then, and I don't know how I got turned on to it. I think it was maybe somebody, let me think about this. If somebody I knew.
Look.
I think I was talking, I was talking to somebody. Oh, yeah, look at that. There you go. I think, isn't that called Where's Roger or something?
It is.
Is it?
But you can only get those effects with Open. It must have been with Open.
No, it wasn't.
Well, you would know.
No, it wasn't. The reason I got Open, I was talking to somebody and God, my memory's so bad. I think it's just so much stuff in my head. It's crazy. But I was saying, because what happened was I started off when the voice in my head in my den said, it's time to start oil painting now, when I was winding up my solo singing career, because I was just so fed up with the struggle and somebody else had kind of messed some business up for me, and it killed me. I just thought, I got to do something else. So I thought, well, you know, what am I going to do? And I thought, well, I like photography. And people said, why don't you teach music? Well, I don't read music. I don't write music. I'm deaf in one ear. You know, I mean, that's not really.
You know. Perfect.
What was that? What Perfect. Was that? Yeah. And, and so, yeah, a voice in my head said, it's time to start oil painting now. And I went and I thought, it's clear as day. I've had that happen 3 times in my life now. And I thought, right, I'm going to act on that. And I did. And I changed my sunroom into a studio. And I went and bought lots of paint, oil paints. I bought a book on oil painting, but I'm not a reader. I feel so bad when I say that, so I'm so ignorant. But I've never been a reader, even when I was a child. I mean, I'd read what I had to read, but for some reason, I don't think I can remember. It doesn't stay there if I read something. But anyway, so but I bought a book. I thought, I've really got to read this. I read one page and I got bored. And I thought, oh, I can't be bothered with this. Anyway, so 2 months went by and I was waiting. I bought everything. And I just one day woke up and I thought, today's the day. And so I went out into my garden. I picked a big tiger lily. And I thought, where do I start? Because I didn't read the book, you know. So I sat there and I thought, well, you know, I'll do the sky first and I'll do blah, blah, blah. And I did this flower and I thought, I'm not meant to do flowers. I'm not a flower, I'm not a flower girl. I've never been, you know, in the 70s when everybody was wearing all these really, you know, high heels and flowery dresses, that really wasn't me, you know. I don't know what, I'm not a man, you know. I don't want to be a man. I'm not gay, for anybody out there. I'm not. unless the money's right. Until this virus, you know, kills me, whatever. Anyway, and so I did this flower and I was so disappointed. And I thought, okay, but when I did that, I felt like when I was doing the grass at the bottom, the green, I felt like somebody was holding my hand. And so that was really special. So I thought, well, this isn't right. Don't get upset. I think I did 5 paintings that day. 5 or 6. I couldn't stop, like the floodgates opened. So I thought, I'm going to do the grass. So I did the grass, and again, I felt this hand holding my hand, and this flow was coming out, and I said, whoa. And it was all green. It's all green, this picture, but it's all got the depth in, you know, a little bit of the depth that my paintings, you know, became later on. And then the third one I just got some red and some blue, and I had no idea what was coming. Like, it's usually the same with me. And I think with you, sometimes you plug into something and it all comes in from somewhere. It's amazing. What a gift that is, you know? I did this painting and it was all red and it looked like a big sun. And then the sky had this pale blue and red swirls in it. And I thought, whoa, what's this? And then all of a sudden in front of me, in my studio, right about 6 inches away from me, a little red spider appeared on a piece of silk. And it's right in front of me. It's like a dark red, bright dark red, small. I saw it and whoa! And I went like that and it was gone. And when it was gone, my whole studio filled up with the smell of pipe tobacco. And it was Vincent van Gogh. And that painting looks like Vincent van Gogh.
Right.
I can show it to you if you like.
And why not?
Okay, hang on a minute. Thank you. So this one was the first one.
Okay.
You know, with the grass there.
Yep.
And the tiger lily.
Love that one.
Yeah, that's the one with the blue. This, yeah, looking at the, yeah, this is the way up. So that's the sun and that's the sky with all the blue and the red swirls in it. And that's when that, and it's that smell stayed in my studio for months, months and months. And I got that. I get that. Also with Leonardo da Vinci, if I do something, because I love him, he's my favourite. Apart from you, I like your work as well.
There's a relief.
He's the first, you're the second. I remember this.
It's not bad being second to him.
I'd do a painting and I just use brushes because people said, do you use your fingers? I thought, no, I don't use my fingers. But you know, just because of some of the effects, and I was doing this something with the brush and it looked like a piece of velvet. Mm. And I thought, wow, my God, or it looked like a piece of silk. And I didn't do it thinking, oh, I've got to paint. You know, if there's any restrictions on anything, I can't do it. You know, if I just let everything go and not even think about it, it just pours in and then it's like, you know. I've lost my train of thought now. What we were talking about, something else. But anyway, I know that you have said that you more or less have a similar kind of thing to me, don't you? Where, and it has a word. What is it? Oh, hopefully I'll remember it. Somebody wrote to me and said that you have this. Where, you know, you get these people that can smell colour.
Synesthesia.
That's it. That's what this guy said. He said, that's what you've got. And then I thought, you're right, because I started painting songs. I can paint one, any song you want, I can paint it. And what I do is, it's funny, I've done maybe three or four Northern Lights, and it's they're not never the same, because what I do is I get the person to send me a photograph of themselves so that I can tune into them. And it's, of course, it's their interpretation through me of what Northern Lights is to them. Does that make sense? But painting songs. I love doing pet portraits. I mean, it takes me 5 minutes to do the background for a pet portrait. You know, there's one here actually.
All right. Oh, amazing. Is that yours?
Yeah. That's Bugle. So every pet's different. Obviously. They're all different, aren't they? So that's something that I've been doing for a while. I absolutely love it because I kind of... It takes longer to do the faces and everything. I usually... print out a photograph and trace it just so for the eyes it saves me time, just to know where everything is, you know. I did the first one and of a cat and it wasn't too bad actually, but and then I just kind of, something happens, I just tune into that pet.
One of the things I was going to do, because what got me off on doing these talks was conversations I'd had in the past about where do ideas come from.
Yeah.
And this sounds to me like this is exactly what you're talking about right now, where ideas come from.
You know, somebody says to me once, my friend Laura Gardner, we do the artwork together. She's the graphic side of things. I'm not very good at, you know, putting an album. I can paint but putting it all together in a package is very difficult, you know, that side of it. So she does that, but I spent a lot of time with her over the years. And when the kids were younger, they were about, I don't know, 5 or 6 or something like that. And they said, can you teach us how to paint? So I've done this also with Michael Dunford's Toussaint's as well. We did that in England. And I said, look, what you need to do is you can't think about what you're doing at all. You really need to just sit and just, it's,
that's right.
Not everybody can do, I can't meditate. So I think I meditate when I paint. You know, I can't sit down. I just can't do it. It's just not, because there's so much in my mind. But if I know that I'm doing a painting, it's a whole different thing when I'm creating that kind of thing. I never knew this was coming. I went to art school, funnily enough, to be a dress designer. And, you know, so your mother went for fashion design, didn't she?
She did fashion drawing.
The similar kind of thing. I've got a funny shadow on my face. Looks like I've got a black beard now. Or changing faces of Annie Aslam. Bloody hell. Oh, there you go. That's a nice beard. That's a nice look.
There you go. Is the shadow? Is the shadow your computer? Is the computer casting a shadow?
That's better, isn't it?
Yeah, that's better.
We start again then.
We can do it again, for sure. But let's do it again additionally rather than instead of.
Right, yeah. No, where are we now? See, that's where my brain goes. Oh, yeah, so what I did is I sat down and said, this is what I did with both boys, actually. They both got boys. They're grown up now. And I said, you just need to sit down and relax and just don't think about anything. Don't think you're going to copy me. You just got to feel the flow, you know, just think about something flowing, not like you've got to do a straight line or anything like that. And all of them came up with really, really fabulous things because they managed to do it.
I find I listen to books on tape because I find that the perfect way of totally distracting me. It just takes my thinking mind out of the equation. It switches it off. And so when I'm focusing on that, I can get on with the work.
So you listen to books. Yeah, what I do is... Oh, what's that? Who's that? Somebody scratching. It's one of my pets here. Oh, well. I like to have in the background an old movie, and I've seen, and even though I don't look at it very much, it's I like British movies. I'm going to try and get rid of this. Where is that? Oh. Who's scratching? Stop it. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
Angel? I don't know where she is. Anyway, I like Rebecca, the movie.
Oh, yeah.
And I've, God knows how many times I've had that on, but it's just, the whole feel of that is, it's such an incredible movie. I love it. And, you know, Daphne du Maurier lived down the road from me in Cornwall.
Yeah.
And I got to meet her years later. I got to meet her. Just, what a thrill.
You did?
Yeah, hang on a sec. Sorry. Who is this scratching? Angel? It's my little dog Angel. She found her way into my office. You scratched it out. There she is.
Ah.
She was a puppy mill dog.
Hello.
She lived in a rabbit cage for 3 years.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So she came to me. Yeah. So I guess probably because I met her, but I love her work anyway, Daphne du Maurier.
Yeah.
Because I lived in Foy, we moved down to Cornwall for my mother's health. when I was 13. And she lived close by in the house called Menabilly, which that was the house on the it overlooked the ocean and everything, the sea. And that's the one that they based Rebecca on, you know. And then years later, I was visiting Cornwall and she'd moved to another house called Kilmarth. And that was another one that was like not far from the other one that she was in. And I just went just to walk around, just to reminisce, really. I didn't know anybody else that lived there. And there she was, a place was there, you could see in the distance, and there was a big, gigantic field. And I was with a friend of mine, and I walked up to the gate, and here she comes walking towards us across the field. And she just came up and said hello. It was like amazing. So that's, you know, I love listening, watching, not really watching them, but having that kind of thing in the background. And it's wonderful.
Yeah.
So, sometimes music, but I think something about, you know, old movies. And, you know, I used to go out with Norman Wisdom's son. So every now and again, I'll put a Norman Wisdom movie on. I met him, you know, once. I opened the door into his house. He opened the door and I burst out laughing. And I said, I'm so sorry. Because my mum and everybody loved Norman Wisdom, you know.
Yeah.
Mr. Grimsdale!
I met him once too. It was, he was one of the guests on Rick Wakeman's This Is Your Life. And I was invited along to that too.
They lived in the Isle of Man, didn't they? That's why. I guess we got, that's how they became close friends, I would say.
That's right.
Yeah. And so Rick Wakeman, yeah. Now he's a funny man, isn't he?
He is.
I like him. I like Rick. When he came to Philadelphia once, he was playing with his son, Adam. And yeah. I was with my ex-husband, Mark, and Ed Sharkey, who's a very famous DJ in the Philadelphia area, who was responsible for us. You know, he played us all the time in the 70s, and that's, he helped, you know, turn everybody on to us.
They honour him as launching Yes in America.
That's right. Yes as well. And, all right, I've lost my train of thought. Where was I?
You were talking about seeing Rick Wakeman there.
Oh, that's right. So we went to see, we met him for a curry. Like,
okay.
Like it's we famous, all do.
Very
like
famous curries.
You can't have a curry. Oh, God. Yeah, we had a curry with my ex-husband, Mark. Me, Ed, Rick and Adam, and we went for a curry before the show. I think it was after the surgery, before the show. I'm glad I wasn't on that stage.
Rick is notorious for having curries delivered during the show.
That's a good idea.
I've never seen it, but it's the rumour.
Oh, God. I've got a very rude story to say about that one. I don't know whether to tell you or not. I'm going to tell you because it's very funny. It was extremely embarrassing. But anyway, let me tell you about this first. So we had this dinner and Rick was so filthy in what he was saying about everything. I mean, I love that. It's just dirt box humour, isn't it? That's what you called it, litter box humour. We couldn't stop laughing, and Ed as well, but my ex-husband really was like, it was a bit too much for him. But we, I remember, do you want me to tell you this story? It's a bit rude.
Well, you're going to have
it's
to
not really,
tell me.
It's not really rude. You can always cut it out if you don't want it. What's that shadow there? we were playing at the Capitol Passaic, which was a John Scher venue in New Jersey, and he was our manager at the time. And on the day off, we never did this again after that. Sorry, what's that light there?
Well, that's good.
Keeps coming. There you go. That's a bit
there
better.
Yeah.
So anyway, we'd had a curry on the day off. That's not good. Oh. And I was a bit concerned in the morning. I went to the bathroom and I thought, well, I'm okay. No. So, but during the day, we got to the venue, the stage was ginormous, huge stage, very, very deep. And at the back of the stage, there was like this area where they put the flight cases, you roll them in there, you know. And I was on stage and everybody was setting up the stuff and they really weren't quite ready for me. So I thought, okay, so I just went and I thought, oh God, oh no, oh no, oh no. And I there's nowhere I could go because my body was just, so I went to the very, very back of the stage. I'm showing you my house, aren't I? Here we go. That's a fireplace I don't use.
Okay.
Because there's a painting in front of it. I go to the very back and I thought, I couldn't, you know, I had wind. As my dad used to say, have you just done a pardon me, Aram? So I was dying and I thought, oh, and so I stayed there. I kept hiding. Because I thought, I can't move yet, you know. Oh, my God. And then John Borah, bless his heart, he was our tour manager and he was my guardian angel. He used to look really watch over me. He went, Annie, where are you? We need you on the microphone. Sound check, you know. And I didn't feel safe. I didn't feel that the air around me was safe. So I kind of sidled over as slowly as I could, hoping that there was nothing following me. And I was in front of the microphone and John looked at me and said, and the microphone was on, Annie, have you just farted? It went everybody, you know, all the PA and everything.
But no audience, hopefully.
So that's a pardon me. Yeah. And you know what another name for a fart is in Lancashire? A trump.
I see. Yes, I heard.
Yeah, have you? That's another one my dad used to say. Have you trumped Aram? Not that I'm not saying to everybody that I do it a lot. Certainly it wasn't eating curries when I was a little girl, you know.
So, we haven't done that.
You treated us, me. Who else was it at Nearfest that time? Who was with me? Anyway, whoever I was with that was helping me, you, Krista, remember my friend Krista?
Yeah.
I think Krista was there helping me. And you took us out for a meal because I remember you shuffling us around saying, you don't want to sit there because you don't want your back to the door. And it can't sit over there because this, that, and the other. So half an hour later when we found a table, was that an Indian restaurant?
You know what? Finding somewhere to eat there was a nightmare, wasn't it?
Bethlehem.
It was Bethlehem. But you know what? Later, we discovered up on the hill opposite, there were some great restaurants. It's just they weren't near the university where we were.
That's right. Yeah. You've got to be in the right spot.
Yeah. I like Bethlehem, actually.
It's lovely, isn't it? It's beautiful at Christmas time because because it's on a hill as well. They put a star up at Christmas, you know. It might be there all the time. I'm not sure. But...
What we haven't talked about is UFOs, music. In fact, pretty much anything, really.
I know there's a lot of stuff. You know, people say, "Why don't you write a book?" I could never write a book because I don't want to go into my past. I don't mind talking about it in an interview or whatever, but I would have to put everything in there because that's who I am, and it would upset a lot of people. I'm not into that. Why would you want to do that just to make money? Or you can make some money at it. I'd rather not have any money. I wouldn't be able to live like that, you know? And not that way. That's why I'm broke. But it's okay. No, you know, I'm not like that. I'm not like a money-grabbing person or blah, 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 blah.
I don't think you should write a book to make money. I think you should write a book because it would be fascinating.
I know. Well, the most important thing is I would have to tell, I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that would shock a lot of people. I wouldn't want to do it.
Then don't.
I tell close friends though sometimes.
Okay.
I
can see that. Oh no, we started quarter of an hour late. I thought we'd been running an hour. We haven't. But this time or next time, are you going to tell me about what you hinted at in your letter?
Oh yeah. Well, it started off. I was working in a flour mill, but I was a receptionist. I wasn't actually in the mill with the flour, putting it in bags, you know. No. I used to live in, where was I living then? Chingford, North Chingford. And I used to have to get a bus to the flour mill that was down in Enfield Way, that around that area. Ponder's End, I think it was called, and it was a family business, and I was just, I hadn't started singing then, but it was coming close, but I had no idea what I was going to be doing, really, so I had to work to keep going, so I get this job, and I was at the bus stop, and it was, I guess it must have been, would that be winter time? It was dark at 7 o'clock, anyway, it was kind of getting light, but anyway, we were about 10 people at the bus stop, and somebody said, "What's that up there?" And it looked like this silver cigar floating across the sky. And I never forgot that. I mean, we all saw it. And then the next time anything happened was the morning of my father's funeral in Cornwall. And I went out to pick up the rest of the band that were coming down the train was coming in around 6:30 into St Austell, I think it was, and so I drove down there to pick them up. This was about 6 in the morning. Again, funny enough, it was kind of darkish, you know, and I was with my brother Michael, and he's the kind of person that he wouldn't believe in anything like that. It's got to be like black and white, you know what I mean, that kind of thing. And but we got to the station and the train was delayed for an hour. So we thought, oh, we might as well go home. So we came back home. As we were coming back to my mum's house, and it was just outside Foy and not far from Daphne du Maurier country, it's all around that area. So there were like really tall hedges, you know, narrow roads. And I had a Range Rover at the time, and second hand, I'll add. Got there, it had a very big, you know, the earlier ones had got even bigger windscreens, do you know what I mean? The first Range Rovers. Yeah. And so it was like this giant picture window, and all, and we're driving along there. All of a sudden, in this picture window, we could see, and I said, "I've got to pull over, do you see that?" And he said, "Yeah." And it was three lights in the sky, very bright. I've no idea how far it was away, but we both saw it, and it came closer like that, and still not right on top of us, and then it just stayed there, and then it was gone. Now I think only because of my other experiences and the anagram of my name. Would you like to know the anagram of my name? Alien Shaman.
What?
Alien Shaman. Not good. Anyway, so I've had all kinds of things going on in my life since then. But I think that nothing happened because we were in mourning.
Yes.
So that's what I think. And then, you know, over the years, I've seen things. I was with my ex-husband in Puerto Vallarta. His company had a, every year they used to take their employees on a trip, and it was wonderful. They were really a fantastic company. They did it, and really, really good people. And we were in Puerto Vallarta, but I didn't like the fact that we're in a hotel, and on the other side of the wall where the private beach was, it was just terrible poverty with donkeys and everything in the water. And it was, I didn't like it at all. I would never do that again. But about 3 o'clock in the morning, I think it was, I got out of bed and went to the window. And I saw in the distance, but it was definitely, it was three rows of colored lights. So red, green and yellow, or red, blue and yellow, whatever it was, spinning around. So I woke up Mark. I said, Mark, you've got to come and look at this. And he said, what are you doing, man? I don't, there's a load of rubbish. No, please come and have a look. I said, look there, it's right there in front of you. He said, I can't see anything, go back to bed. So, but then, when was it, 19, oh, when did I go to Brazil for the first time? I went with Michael Dunford in 1979 to promote the album Azure Door, and just do interviews and everything. And then went back again. Two amazing guys in Brazil who were fans contacted me and said, why don't you come down to Brazil? I said, well, you can get me some shows, I'll come down. So I did, but I only went with one other guy, David Biglin. And we did a show, he took some tapes, I don't know if he did it, it's amazing. A clairvoyant told me, you're going to go overseas a long way and you're going to only go with one musician. I said, no way, that's not going to happen. How can I sing a Renaissance song with one person, you know? Then that happened. So we had shows in Sao Paulo, Rio, and a place called Petropolis, which is outside of Rio, about 2 or 3 hours up in the mountains. This place is gorgeous. And it had a cathedral, and nearly all the trees had orchids growing on them. You know, it's just this. Have you been to Brazil?
No.
You have been?
No.
Wow. It's just the most wonderful thing about it, though, are the people. I love the people. And, you know, we've been there several times now. But we were playing in Petropolis. And I was outside of my dressing room on this little hill, and David Biglin was out there, my friend Carlos and somebody else who worked, and the place was packed. It was called the Acoustic Shell, and it looked a little bit like the Egg in Albany, but smaller, and it was all made of wood. We didn't know what it was going to sound like, to be honest, but it came out great. So just before that, I did my exercises. I was standing doing my breathing exercises, and my friend Carlos was there. And I went, whoa, look at that up there. And I said, this is a UFO. David Biglin said, no, it's not, but that is. And we saw this, it was crazy. It was close to the cathedral. It was it had a spire on it, that kind. And we were looking at it. I've got to go and get my camera. I nearly broke my neck. I got running to get I had a Hi8, Canon Hi8. Brought it back, said, Carlos, come here. I've got to hold this on your shoulder. And he was shaking. He said, I don't want to. I'm like, just stop shaking. I've got to film this. I zoomed in on it and I got it on film. And so when I got back from Brazil, I contacted my friend at Inside Edition. And he's one of the producers there. And I said, Chris, I've got this video of the UFO. And we the album that we recorded, the three shows, and the album was going to be called Under Brazilian Skies. And he said, well, this would be amazing for your release and everything, the UFO, you know. And I'd already done a thing for Inside Edition when I put on that concert called Lilies in the Field and brought in Justin Hayward and all that lot, you know. That's another time. There's too much to tell you, really. But anyway, so he said, well, come up and let's have a look at it. So I went up, and he took me into the editing suite. Just before then, he introduced me to this guy who was the foremost expert on UFOs at that time. And so he was there with us. So that was me, the engineer, and this guy, Chris. And so he put the, and I, of course the camera was shaking, so it was moving all over, but he did manage to stop it where it was sharp, and he got a shot of it, the guy, the editor, and he didn't believe in UFOs at all, you know. And but the weirdest thing is, and like, it was, I can remember it now because I thought my heart was going to stop. When he stopped it, it was a face in the sky. And it was like, you know, the Mayan, you know, the Mayan carvings are all kind of rigid, aren't they, square and things. But it looked like Jesus. It could be Jesus. And we all swore. It's a face, you know, it's a face. And it was like, we couldn't stop saying, it's a face. Anyway, he turned the knob one more time, and there it was, a UFO. And the top of it was pale pink, and the bottom of it was dark pink. And the guy said, that type of UFO is very, very common in Brazil. So, but anyway, because I'd lost my point of interest, you know, and I focused in on the cathedral, it didn't, I lost the point of, what do you call it? Point of interest. What do you call it? Anyway, because I'd zoomed in and you couldn't see the cathedral, right? Because I'd lost it because I, you know, zoomed in. So that was that. And so,
you still have
and when I started painting though, Roger, the weirdest thing was, so the first painting was a flower, and you know, I knew straight away that I got upset, as I said, because I thought, why am I painting a flower? And it's awful. It's not very good. You know, I thought, no, this is not what it's about. And then I did the grass, and then I did the, you know, the Vincent painting without knowing what was coming. And then the next one after that was the UFO over the ocean. And without any thought, no thought whatsoever. So my guest room is full of all these different paintings of different planets and landing strips and all kinds of stuff.
Amazing. And do you still have the recording you made of it?
I do, yeah.
That's good.
So have you ever seen anything like that at all? Any experiences?
I saw something so tiny, it could have been anything. This would have been 1957-ish in Hong Kong. And I saw a little speck, which I just assumed was an aeroplane. But it moved too fast, because you see an aeroplane when it's a little speck, you know, it just moves across,
right?
You know, really slowly. But this went like that across. It could have been, but I was very curious about it.
Well, it wouldn't have been a satellite, would it?
Well, in those days, it could have been Sputnik.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Sputnik. There was a band called the Sputniks, wasn't there?
There was, but there was also a satellite called Sputnik.
Yeah, I bet
the
you saw something.
First one.
Yeah, I bet you saw something there.
I don't know. It certainly was an option.
Right. I'm open to everything, really. Because I've had so many different experiences, you know. Oh, I'll tell you one. When we played in Korea, it was, when was it, 2011, in Seoul, with Renaissance. And we only went out for two shows. It was crazy. And it was when Mr. Kim, do you remember the dad, Mr. Kim, was handing over everything to his son, the leadership and everything to his son. And they in North Korea, they were having this giant parade. It was the second day that we were performing, because it was 2 days in the same place, the Mapping Center, I think it was. It was really did very well. I think it was sold out both nights. The audience were amazed because Renaissance in any form had never been there. So it was really wonderful. So the second night, I was on stage, and we had a different light and a different sound engineer for this one, Chris, who we hadn't used before, and he talked to the lighting people about the lights, and I'd already got the lighting plot to give him. So we don't use. You know, my advice is never use dry ice unless you've got people that are experts on how to use it, you know. And so wherever we, and also sometimes they use it, it's got oil in it. And that's really bad for singers. But anyway, so that wasn't an issue. I didn't even think of it because it was in the rider and it wasn't used anyway. But what happened was in a song called Midas Man, in the second verse, for a split second while I was singing, Mr. Kim, his face came, it was right there in front of me, right there, split second. And I said, I'm sending love to you, Mr. Kim. I'm sending love to you, Mr. Kim, in my mind. And then in a second, he was gone. So I clipped a word. I clipped a word in that, it was happening that fast. It was only his face right there, right there. So anyway, I thought, well, I've got to put myself together here. So I'd forgotten about it because I had to do, you know, the rest of the show. So when I came off stage, Chris came up to me, said, Annie, he said, the weirdest thing happened when you were on stage. He said, in Midas Man, in the second verse, in the second line, there was a white mist around you. A white mist appeared around you. And he said, I went to the girl who was there doing the, you know, because you usually have the lights and the sound close to each other. And he was shouting, I told you no dry ice. She said, I'm not touching anything.
That is weird.
Isn't that the weirdest thing? And I went to Japan when they had the tsunami. I went there I took one of my painted guitars for an auction. A friend of mine donated his ticket so I could go club class. And it was incredible. I was there, but I was there too long. It was upsetting to fly in and see all the debris in the water and walk through the streets, you know, where there was wires everywhere. You know, because a lot of the electricity was still cut off. And so a similar thing happened when I went on stage, and I went on stage about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I got jet lag. And, you know, God, well, you've been to Japan, haven't you?
Yeah, Freya.
Yeah, Freya lives there, doesn't she?
Yeah.
That jet lag has got to be the worst. Well, that in Australia, I guess. But yeah. And so I was... I haven't got rid of my jet lag until I get home. Do you know what I mean? But I was singing at 1:30 in the morning, and I had these young Japanese musicians who played Back Me Up. They were fabulous. And I was so tired, but a similar thing happened there as well. But I don't know what it was or who it was, but there was something else. There was a connection with something in Japan when I was singing. It kind of took me away, you know. So, I mean, there's something about whatever... my past is my karma, you know, that people, you know, hang around, you know.
Was that the Tokyo Prog Festival with Steve Hackett?
No, that was when I went to, I just flew on my own to donate that guitar to raise funds for the kids that had lost all their musical instruments and everything. It was connected to Music Cares as well. So it was in Nagoya. I went, yeah. Okay. But we did the open air thing with Steve. That was, God, that it was about 98 degrees on that stage. There was no air anywhere. And all the fans had fans. I thought, what one of those fans? And it's the only time ever in my career I've sung with sweat pouring down my face constantly.
I can send you one of those fans.
Oh, can you?
Yeah, I literally have probably 30 or 40 of them.
Oh, really?
Because I designed the stuff for that festival.
Oh, did you? Oh, yes, you did. I remember that now.
Yeah. Well, you won't meet the fan immediately, but
I was. It was, but watching them, it was like it was torture. It was done on purpose, you know. But yeah,
Annie, we've been talking for just over an hour.
Oh, sorry.
And we haven't even got to half the things I want.
I know, got to music.
And music, of course. But we nearly did.
I have to tell you one thing, though, that really helped me musically during you know, the pandemic and what's going on now, is that I had a birthday video that was made up for me by Jeffrey Langley, who's one of the keyboard players now. And it was fabulous. He got Jeff Downs to put a message on there, Steve Hackett, Michael from Opeth. Do you know Mikhail? Do you know? Oh, yeah, him. I what I did afterwards is I contacted everybody to say thank you. When I was thanking Jeff, I said, how do you feel about writing a song for John, you know, John Wetton? Yeah. And so he said, oh, that's a great idea. And like, so now he came up with a title pretty quickly called Stars in Heaven. And I wrote the words about my experiences, you know, going over to see John. And when was it? 2000. Oh, gosh, it seems so long ago now. 2003, was it? But anyway, John was a very big fan of ABBA. So this song, oh, yeah. And I love ABBA. I mean, I think they're great. and so it has this wonderful ABBA feel, but it's all me, you know. And I love harmonizing with myself because I can sing high and I can sing low, you know. And it worked really well. So that it's really kind of... help me get, you know, just doing some music, because I can't do anything with my band. And to do a Zoom thing with our band, it's just, I don't want to sing Mother Russia in my kitchen, you know. I can't. I don't want people to remember me for that, you know. So it was fun. So that really helped me get through this, and it's not come out yet, but it's, you know, it's almost finished. I did my vocals and with Rave up in Warwick, New York, and didn't have to wear a mask in the studio, thank goodness, because you can't sing it with a mask on.
But I'm not sure if this isn't just a false memory, but for some reason I think you could sing arias, you could sing soprano.
Well, I'm a coloratura soprano, and I started singing, I went for singing lessons. I went to Shirley Bassey's teacher first, he couldn't take me on in the daytime. He couldn't take me on in the evening because I had a daytime job, and he worked only in the daytime. So he put me on to an opera singer called Sybil Knight, and I was with her for about 9 months. That's where I found I'd got 5 octaves, you know, because I was breathing from my diaphragm and not from my throat. She wanted me to go into opera. She said, your voice is, and she said, it's an unusual, you have an unusual tone in your voice, and you know, it would be great for you. But I didn't want to be stuck in one place all the time. And I just didn't know where I was going to go at that point either. I just had no idea, no plans, nothing. You know, but it's a long story. Can I come back?
Yeah, shall we do another one and talk about the music and the singing?
Yeah, let's do that, because it's a shame to rush it, really.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I did actually plan not to talk about music. I thought we would talk about other things, the art, where ideas come from. Which we did a little bit.
Yeah.
And I thought we would save the music. So if you're up for it, we'll do it again.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, when we finished, I'm going to send you a copy of this, but you might not get it till tomorrow morning because.
Okay, no problem.
I'm going to go and see Steve Howe now. So.
You go what?
I'm going over to the studio to see Steve.
Oh, where is he?
is recording at Curtis Schwartz Studio, which is about 8 miles away.
Yeah. Give him my love, will you, please?
I will. Absolutely, yeah. I will. Yeah. Annie, thank you so much for joining me. I have to stop because you can hear my voice is saying goodbye.
Oh, really? You see, I could go on
enough forever. Today.
because I learned to breathe properly, I can talk forever.
Well, it's a bit late for me to learn to breathe.
No. Actually, you know, there's a guy called Wim, W-I-M, Huff, H-U-F-F, and he holds a Guinness records for breathing under the ice or something ridiculous. But this guy is very healthy, and he has the most amazing breathing exercises. Very, 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 very simple. You can just look him up and I'll see if I can find the one that I did. It's really easy, but like after doing it for like 5 minutes, not even 5 minutes actually, you're breathing differently, because that's why we get sick, a lot of it. You know, we're not breathing. You know, all of a sudden I think I'm not breathing. Oh, hang on.
Well, if you find it, please send me a link.
I will. I'll look for it in a minute and send it to you. It's brilliant. Because if you're talking a lot like this, you need to keep your voice tuned up, you know.
I do. Annie, it's brilliant. Thank you so much.
I'm sorry I was a bit rude. And if anybody's watching me, you know, that I don't mean to say rude things, but I like to make people laugh, you know, and I think I like to shock people sometimes as well.
I think you'll have done both. I thought it was brilliant. And I think you're wonderful and very brave.
Thank you. All right, give my love to Freya.
And Steve, I will.
Yeah, and let me know when you want to do it again. That's not a problem. I might try and find a better place in the house.
Oh, I love this place, right opposite the paintings.
Yeah.
And where you're sitting now is better than where you were at the beginning.
Yeah, it is much better. Well, it's the lights changing outside in the curtain and all that stuff, you know, like it does.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Roger.
See you soon.
Yeah, talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.